Welcome to the Friday edition of Political Rewind. It is 3:06 in the afternoon. I say Friday edition because I want to remind everybody we're now on 2 days a week with all the political activity going on out there. You can hear us on Wednesdays live at 2 p.m. and we continue at 3 on Fridays. Boy, do we have a lot to talk about this week. And joining us, as he usually does, Jim Galloway, the political reporter, writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the man who oversees Political Insider, the daily blog that keeps you updated hour to hour about what's happening politically. Todd Rehm, political consultant for Republican candidates, and also the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which is also a great daily source of news about politics. Former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden is back with us this week from Cobb County. It's always a pleasure to have you here, Buddy, and welcome back and Happy New Year to you.
Glad to be back.
And for the first time, Bradley George, host of Morning Edition on 88.5 here in Atlanta. Bradley, it's great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
As well. All right, Jim Galloway. I think, unless this was somebody trolling you, that last night, in the middle of the Republican debate, I saw a Facebook post from you that essentially said, I've never seen anything like this in my life. Was that, in fact,
that
you?
That was me. In 40 years, I have never seen an exchange like the one, the first one that happened between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. I was flummoxed. I was flabbergasted. My jaw just dropped 4 inches. And then you had the sequel, the New York sequel.
So I think it's safe to say, and we're going to unpack all of that and listen to some of the exchanges you're talking about. But I think we need to start by saying, Todd Rehm, we all know this has certainly been the most interesting, probably exciting presidential race. And in a lot of ways, entertaining as well. Last night certainly continued that new tradition, didn't it?
It did. And, you know, I think it's when you have a master showman on, it always is going to spice something up. I was reading something the other day about how when Donald Trump started on The Apprentice, he was very resistant to any coaching, to any idea that he could improve upon himself. But that after the first 6 months or however long, he started accepting coaching. And so he has been coached on television appearances for 8 or 10 years, and it shows. I think what's becoming increasingly clear is that you got to keep your eye on Ted Cruz when he has a microphone in his hand as well. He is an accomplished debater.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, Buddy. You know, I mean, we've known for a while that Cruz has been gaining momentum in many of the polls, and is seen as something of a Trump Jr., the guy who voters might turn to if Donald Trump starts to go downhill. But I'm not sure until last night people saw quite the kind of debater, the kind of mind he has. This is a formidable, whether you like his politics or not, this is a formidable intellect.
He's formidable, he's bright, he's smart. However, I think he overplayed his hand when he brought up the New York lifestyle. And in my opinion, what good he did over the birth issue, he erased when he brought up New York, because that was Trump's finest moment I've seen in the entire campaign.
All right,
came back and defended New York.
I want to start talking about that, but I wanted to go around and give each of you a chance to just your general observations about last night, Bradley.
Well, Buddy mentioned the New York lifestyle jab that the Ted Cruz threw, and Corey Lewandowski, who's Trump's campaign manager in Politico today, says he's talking about Ted Cruz, and he says, well, what are they, Calgary values? And it's referring to this, Ted Cruz was born in Calgary, and there's this effort to discredit the fact that he might be a U.S. citizen. And even today in Texas, there was a lawsuit filed that that challenges his eligibility to run for president.
All right, so good. All right. Thank you for all just weighing in briefly. Now let's start going at the specifics of this really entertaining and in some ways enlightening debate last night. So the first thing is what we've already referred to. As we know, Ted Cruz has felt that the best way for him to succeed as a candidate is to play nice with Donald Trump, assuming Trump's support's eventually going to fade. He wants to gain that support. Well, last night, the gloves came off between them. And it started when Cruz was asked the question about his eligibility to be president. And that began an exchange, which a series of exchanges. We'll play little bits and pieces of it. So let's listen first to Ted Cruz. You'll hear Donald Trump and hear Cruz some more.
My friend Donald said that he had had his lawyers look at this from every which way. And there was no issue there. There was nothing to this birther issue. Now, since September, the Constitution hasn't changed. But the poll numbers have. And I recognize that Donald is dismayed that his poll numbers are falling in Iowa. Donald's mother was born in Scotland. She was naturalized. Now, Donald...
But I was born here.
On the issue of citizenship, Donald...
Big difference.
On the issue of citizenship, Donald, I'm not going to use your mother's birth against you.
Okay, good. Because it wouldn't work. NBC Wall Street Journal just came out with a poll. Headline, Trump way up, Cruz going down. I mean, so don't... So you can't... They don't like the Wall Street Journal, they don't like NBC, but I like the poll. And frankly, it just came out. And in Iowa now, as you know, Ted, in the last three polls, I'm beating you. So, you know, you shouldn't misrepresent how well you're doing with the polls. You don't have to say that. In fact, I was all for you until you started doing that, because that's a misrepresentation.
All right, Galloway, this was the exchange you've never seen the likes of which before. We should point out what was interesting is Ted Cruz appropriated a great line from Ronald Reagan, who made that same comment in his campaign against...
Walter Mondale.
Mondale,
and it was, I'm not going to use...
Your age against you.
Your youth and inexperience against you,
how
yes.
old Reagan was.
But Trump still has him talking about his issue that he's brought up against Cruz. And even if Cruz does successfully defend it, what he has done is he's thrown the dead cat on the table, and that's all they want to talk about.
We are supposedly serious politicos here. So let's have that. Yes, it was entertaining, and no, you couldn't take your eyes away from it. But let's remember, this is supposed to be a presidential debate.
Okay, absolutely. That is well said and fair. But just for another moment, to talk about the magnetism and the abilities of Donald Trump, which are going to play a role in the elections coming
Absolutely.
Up. He had the audience booing for a moment as he went after Cruz. And yet, Bradley, by the end of his exchange, they were all laughing with him when he said, when he made his comment about, well, I like the poll because it shows me out front. He's got a remarkable ability to bring an audience to him.
Well, I think it's that I've never heard a politician talk so much about polls, because it's always that old thing about the only poll matters on election day. And I think it's kind of that it's that showmanship aspect that Donald Trump brings to it, for better or for worse, is that, yeah, I'm up in the polls, wink, wink. You know, it's just something for him to just kind of, you know, it's that kind of showmanship thing that he's so good at. But what's really interesting about this to me is if the next 2-3 weeks are going to be this mutually assured destruction between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump going after each other, is that going to drive voters away from both of them toward Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, whoever else is out there?
Todd, let me get you in here.
I think one of the things that we're learning this campaign is that there's not really a way to drive some people away from Donald Trump. You know, we have seen remarkable resilience in the polls to him. I am constantly curious about his obsession with the publicly released polls, and I wonder if they're doing their own polls at all.
Yeah.
Or if they're just kind of coasting on what's publicly released and really is not useful as a tool. But I, you know, Trump is, he's one of a kind, he's unprecedented. And so all of the things that people like me can say back in this election, back in that election, none of it applies. But what I do think we're going to learn this year is whether professional, traditional campaigning makes a difference anymore, or if there is a new way to do things that's never been done.
I will tell you, in the debate, you could see people mimicking Trump and his style. I mean, Marco Rubio
yep.
was going after Ted Cruz in high Trump style, and they are speaking words that they would never have spoken before. I mean, again, another gee whiz moment was when Marco Rubio was telling Ted Cruz, "It's silly to talk about eliminating the IRS. It's never going to happen." Todd, have you ever heard anyone from a GOP platform say that?
No, not anyone who had any chance of winning.
So, buddy, Jim Galloway reminds us that we are in the midst of an actual presidential campaign where there's more than entertainment at stake here. So let's ask the question. Is the eligibility issue, in fact, real, or is it something that Trump is using to undermine Cruz's support and that we in the media are picking up because we love this kind of story?
I assess it about 30% being real and about 76% not being real. But what Trump has been able to do is keep the debate focused on his issues and keep the attention to him. And I did not believe until last night it finally came over to me that Donald Trump may well be the next president of the United States. I had never really considered that fact until seeing last night the attention he continues to draw.
One of the interesting things that Trump has done with the issue on Cruz is he's grabbing him in a bear hug and not saying, "You're not eligible." He's saying, buddy, I want you to be on the ticket as my vice president. This is going to be a problem for you. We don't want our ticket to have to be litigating this for months and months. But I think also it was the first time that I had seen Trump on his heels in the entire campaign. There was a noticeable he was noticeably subdued in his countenance when Cruz was talking, and it took him a little while to get his mojo back.
I completely agree with that, Jim. I was surprised that Trump looked so unsettled, so had his feathers ruffled by Cruz's coming after him.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of almost like watching Rocky and Apollo Creed. No, I mean, both candidates hit the floor during that debate, and both came up and hit back very hard.
So let's talk about the other exchange that I think most people feel Trump may have gotten the better of. And Bradley, I'll start with you, because I do think there's something, if we're now going to use Jim Galloway's measurement, something of substance about this other exchange. And that's that here's Ted Cruz. He'd been testing all these attack lines against Trump in the last week or so. One of them was he's not really a Republican. He used to be a Democrat. He's come over lately. He's never been saved. He isn't really.
And his surrogates are out there saying that. Right?
It's going to get. And it's been, you know, it's funny. It's been a whisper campaign for a while now in Iowa, particularly where there's a huge evangelical base. But as you say, it's going to get bigger and bigger publicly, I think, as we go on. Go ahead.
Well, I'm looking at a quote here. This is Charlie Condon. He's the former Attorney General of South Carolina. He's a surrogate for Ted Cruz. This is an article that's in Politico today, and this is Charlie Condon. He says, "A thrice-married man is going to come into South Carolina expecting to be the Republican nominee. He's pro-choice. He's pro-gay marriage. He's against traditional values. He's New York, and he's got to talk about that."
All right, New York, keyword. So Cruz has been using that, too. He has New York values.
He ain't from around here.
So what is that? What does that mean when you hear that, Jim Galloway?
I have heard that in so many races, buddy. I'm sure you have.
And I've used it.
New York, San Francisco, Chicago.
He ain't from around here. Right, he doesn't understand.
What
us.
Do you mean when you've used that line, buddy?
Well, it didn't work for me, even though I used it several times, because I was trying to identify as being one of the majority of the electorate, so that people will feel a special kinship to me. But guess what? It doesn't work. I've tried it.
All right. And last night, I thought, Todd, Trump seemed to really win that argument by invoking 9/11, the heroism of firefighters, the devastation that New Yorkers felt at having been victims of the largest terrorist attack on U.S. soil. Did he, in fact, put that argument out of reach for Ted Cruz? Or can Cruz go on using that line because voters in Iowa will get what he's talking about?
I think voters in South Carolina in the SEC primary in Iowa will get that. I think it's still there is a potency there somewhere. They may have to tweak it a little bit. But absolutely, Donald Trump won that exchange for two reasons. One was that he did engender some sympathy, which is hard to feel for most people towards New Yorkers. But it was also the first time that you had any sense that Donald Trump had been hurt in his life, and that something was important, that there was something he loved, and that he loves the people of New York. And in that respect, I think it almost humanized him mm-hmm. a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so he won it in ways that, you know, Cruz just walked into a buzzsaw with that one. That was the wrong place to use it.
All right. So let me throw out another question and see if this resonates with any of you. It is my sense that last night, Jim Galloway, we saw the way this Republican field. Now, this is notwithstanding anything can happen between, you know, in Iowa and then in New Hampshire. But at least based on last night, has this become a two-man Trump-Cruz contest with maybe Marco Rubio hanging on it? Bush, Kasich, Christie, where do we stand?
I think it's becoming, we're headed more and more in that direction. Look, you know, Ben Carson wasn't there. He was there, but he wasn't there.
Right.
Jeb Bush kind of made cameo appearances here and there. He gave Trump some very good advice on his ban on Muslims. But after that, he just kind of stepped back and disappeared. I think we're headed for a two base, one establishment candidate race.
Well, let me take slight issue with Jim here yet, because not a single vote has been cast. Not a single caucus has taken place. Not a single vote has been counted. And I think it's still a little early. I campaigned out in Iowa 8 years ago. Biggest mess I've ever been to in my life. And I don't know how in the world they make ends of that. I'll never know that caucus system. And how it'll come out, who knows. But at the same time, at least that's a definitive process. The New Hampshire primary will be a process, a legitimate process. The South Carolina will be one. I think it'll all be over maybe by the South Carolina primary, but I think it's a little early to judge that it's a two-person race yet.
I early this morning watched Fox News doing their post-debate analysis, and John McCain's daughter, Megan, was one of the people who was on talking. And the question came up as to whether some Republicans, Bradley, ought to start thinking about falling on their swords.
Yeah.
Is it time for any of them to, you know, Kasich get out of this thing? Certainly Bush isn't about to get out anytime soon. What about Ben Carson? And she said, as the daughter of a guy who ran for president, she reminded people that her father was being urged to get out of this race at a point before becoming the Republican nominee, because his campaign was completely in collapse. But she also spoke about the ego that it takes to run for president and how difficult it is to take these people out of the bubble in which they're living.
Yeah, and as Todd said, you can't really look at a past election as precedent for what we're seeing in 2016. But I think at some point, you know, some of these candidates have got to decide, all right, you know, we're going to try to stick this through. I mean, they're talking about the RNC met in South Carolina this week, and they were talking about the possibility of a brokered convention. Do you really want that to happen? Or are some of these folks who are polling around 2-3% going to have a reality check and say, okay, we've got to take one for the party here and get out of this thing and back somebody?
I don't see a John Kasich taking one for the party.
No, I don't know whether or not it's going to happen. That's the other thing.
I hear you.
I agree with Jim that Trump and Cruz have both consolidated their positions and they're top tier candidates. And I think the third slot is for an establishment member to be named later. I think Marco Rubio is an interesting character because he has got the ingredients to be one of the finest presidential candidates we've seen in a generation. But there's also there are enough ingredients for him to implode. You know, the issues that his family may have had with money and dealing with other people's money and that kind of stuff. And I think that kind of lurks in the back of the brain of someone like a Kasich or a Christie, that they may just be they may need to wait until somebody else gets a flat tire.
So let's in fact, you set us up for this well. Last night, Chris Christie tried to get a beat on Marco Rubio. He's hoping he can position himself as the alternative to Rubio. And here's what he said at one point after Rubio, he felt, wasn't answering a question that had been asked by the panel.
I'd like to interrupt this debate on the floor of the Senate to actually answer the question you asked, which was on entitlements. Do you remember that, everybody? This was a question on entitlements.
Oh, I'll answer the reason,
now you already had your chance, Marky, you blew it.
Here you go with the Trump kind of
Marky.
So, you know, it sounded great. Christie does have this ability to really, he's great at looking into the camera, talking in a way that he thinks voters will really respond to. And they have often responded to him. But still, is he, after last night, where is he going, Jim?
Iowa. He's got to live in Iowa. He's got to live in Iowa. He's got to do well in Iowa.
Boy.
Given the size of the evangelical vote, though, in Iowa, how do you think that's?
I think that's going to be hard.
All right.
But you do have a set of people. I think Christie, I think Kasich, I think Bush. Really, if they don't lay down a marker in Iowa or New Hampshire, I think they pull out.
Todd, does that seem right to you?
I think it does. But again, you know, you've got so much going on March 1st. I don't think Kasich is really been laying the groundwork. But some of the other candidates are building out across the Southeast as well, waiting for somebody else to collapse.
OK, so let's do this. There's more that I'd like to talk about with the Republican debate and then talk a little bit about Clinton Sanders and then do state politics. But let's take a break, our first break right now, and come back and listen to a few more things that happened last night.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network. Thank you for joining us. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, offering 55 undergraduate and graduate degree programs in more than 250 fields of study.
In Iowa, Republicans are expecting a lot more people to turn out for the caucuses on February 1st.
Some are saying 15% higher, some are saying 30% higher, but we're estimating somewhere between 20 and 25% higher turnout than in 2012.
One reason for the big expected turnout? The unusual Iowa campaign of Donald Trump. Robert Siegel reports from Western Iowa later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
I know that voice. That's Bradley George, who's with us today. He's a Morning Edition host on 88.5. Glad to have you, Bradley. Former congressman, Democratic congressman, Buddy Darden. Todd Ream, Republican consultant, editor of GeorgiaPundit.com. And our friend Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So I'd like to throw something else out at this panel and see how it moves you all. Carly Fiorina in the undercard debate last night had a line in her opening statement that I think we ought to take a little bit of a look at. Let's listen to what she said. Carly Fiorina, Jonathan.
I'm not a political insider. I haven't spent my lifetime running for office. The truth is I've had and been blessed by a lot of opportunities to do a lot of things in my life. And unlike another woman in this race, I actually love spending time with my husband.
Carly Fiorina last night, Buddy, going after Hillary Clinton. So here I wonder a couple things, whether that was really, really below the belt. But the other question is, are we seeing a foreshadowing of how Republicans can imagine running against Hillary? One theme, if she is their nominee, the Clinton marriage?
Well, most Southern women would call that remark catty. And I think it probably hurts Carly Fiorina more than it does Hillary Clinton, because it might evoke some sympathy for her, because Hillary Clinton is out there doing the tough things. And now, sure, a lot of negative things about Hillary Clinton that have come out, but at least it's all out there and it's been going on for a long time. So we'll just have to see how it falls out. But personally, I think that that remark hurt her.
I'll tell you what. I think what it does for me, it underlines the need for Republicans to have a woman on the ticket come November.
Yeah, I wondered about the same thing, Todd, whether this is a great way for her to establish what her line might be if she's the vice presidential candidate.
I think that that particular approach was not the way that sound. That was too personal.
Yeah.
And so that kind of fell flat. But I do think that Bill Clinton's legacy is going to be fair game, because Hillary Clinton was not just a passive spouse. She was an active player in the administration. And I will also mention this. I was listening, and I'm certain it was NPR last night. There was a story about some unease that has been chronic for 10 or 20 years among some folks in the Democratic Party, some folks in the Clinton machine, with the role that Hillary Clinton played in some of the attacks on women who were making accusations against.
Trump has pointed out, Trump has called her an enabler in some ways because she attacked some of the women who came forward, said they weren't believable or whatever.
And that coming from Trump might not be as cutting as coming from a Carly Fiorina if she went that way with an attack instead.
Or a Nikki Haley. Mm-hmm. But I think if you're going to have a person on your ticket attacking Hillary Clinton come November, I think it's going to have to be female.
Right. Right. Interesting.
I just wonder how much more, you know, the Clintons have been in the public eye for so long. And I mean, all this stuff about them and their marriage, it was brought up in two presidential campaigns, both of Hillary's Senate campaigns or presidential campaign in 08. It's like, what more can you say to voters to make them think about this as an issue and something that maybe they should give second thought to if they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton?
But I'll tell you, a lot of these people, that was a long time ago. It also means that a lot of these people will be hearing this for the first time.
There's an entire generation of voters who have no prior knowledge, no firsthand knowledge.
All right. So, buddy, I want to play Darrell Welch, our researcher and booking producer, put together a little montage of comments about Hillary Clinton last night. She might as well have been on stage. Let's listen to just some of the comments that came from first Bush, then Christie, and then Rubio.
Here's my warning to everybody out in the audience tonight. If you're worried about the world being on fire, you're worried about how we're going to use our military, you're worried about strengthening our military, and you're worried most of all about keeping your homes and your families safe and secure, you cannot give Hillary Clinton a third term of Barack Obama.
Hillary Clinton would be a national security disaster. Think about it. She wants to continue down the path of Iran, Benghazi, the Russian reset, Dodd-Frank, all the things that have gone wrong in this country. She would be a national security mess. She might be going back and forth between the White House and the courthouse. We need to stop that.
I would go, first of all, one step further in this description of Hillary Clinton. She wouldn't just be a disaster. Hillary Clinton is disqualified from being Commander-in-Chief of the United States.
All right, so it was Chris Christie first, and then Jeb Bush. I apologize for that. Buddy, certainly, Jeb Bush referring to the fact, he says that she's under investigation by the FBI. By the time she would take office if she were elected, who knows, she might be under criminal indictment. These are lines of attack that we could expect to see in a fall campaign.
Well, there's no doubt that all of these attacks on Hillary Clinton will do well to solidify the Republican base against her. However, the Republican base is already solidified against her, so they're doing what we call preaching to the choir right now. What this election is going to turn on, because Hillary Clinton, if she's a nominee, and I think she will be, at the same time will have a Democratic base just as solid. So what we're doing is fighting for a relatively small amount of votes in the middle there, the independent voters, the ones that lean one way or another, and what we call the persuadable voters. And it's yet to be seen how effective these attacks are going to be. But as Bradley George articulated it a while ago, so much better than I can, everything that's said has been said. And while some of the people might not have heard it, it is general knowledge. And so I think the issue has been joined, and I really don't see how these continued attacks will do anything except solidify the base, make the Republicans more Republican and the Democrats more Democrat, and let's see what the people out here in the small, ever diminishing middle are going to do.
All right, before we get out of Republicans entirely, Jim Galloway, you put something up on Political Insider in the last day or so that Darrell Welch saw.
This, okay.
you want to set this up for us? We're going to play this commercial.
Well, okay, you've had Michael Dukakis in his tank helmet. You've had John Kerry in his camo, yeah. hunting camo. And now you've got Ted Cruz with his hunting face paint.
And he is, and the voice we're going to hear is, what's it, John Robinson?
This is Phil Robinson.
Phil Robinson of
the Duck Dynasty.
Okay, here's the kind of endorsement that you could only hope you could get if you were running for president.
My qualifications for president of the United States are rather narrow. Is he or she godly? Does he or she love us? Can he or she do the job? And finally, would they kill a duck and put him in a pot and make him a good duck gumbo? I've looked at the candidates. Ted Cruz is my man. He fits the bill.
You know, we could laugh at that, Jim, but they're talking to Southern voters there.
That carries in Louisiana and in several parts of Georgia.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and this isn't unusual for... I mean, you know, it's a lot of this is can you really imagine the candidate doing this
right.
when he's not running for office?
Right, right.
And this is, you know, Ted Cruz has been out there. He has fried bacon on with automatic weapons before. So I think this carries.
Yeah, I think that. Except I don't
to a very narrow to a very narrow but determined constituency.
Yep.
When I was in Macon for the Trump event, one of the things that struck me is there was a Duck Dynasty contingent in the audience there, and I think that's part of the non-traditional voters that might be up for grabs.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, let's see who comes to Iowa. Let's see who comes to Iowa, because if Trump brings out a new crowd and people who haven't been before, that's going to be a game changer.
Just on the non-traditional voters point, I just want to ask Todd and Jim, what do we know about efforts to register new voters ahead of the primary here in Georgia? Are any of the candidates on either side of this trying to do
very
that?
Little?
I haven't seen anything, but I can tell you anecdotally, on the way back from the Macon Trump event, I pulled into the Cheddar's up there on Riverside Drive to get something to eat, and I saw a former state rep who was walking in, had been to the same event. She had carried somebody with her, you know, a coworker or something like that, and that person was so enthusiastic over Trump, and it came up in conversation that she had never registered to vote. And so there at the table, somebody pulled out an iPad and she registered to vote, but I haven't seen a concerted effort by anybody to do that in Georgia.
All right, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to get a break out of the way here and come back, talk Democratic candidates. They have a debate coming up Sunday night, and then talk state politics. But as we leave you for a moment, I think it's important to remind everybody, Iowans caucus 2 weeks from Monday. This thing is starting to happen, and it is all coming together, certainly in Iowa, and New Hampshire is just 8 days later on February 8th. So
coming ready or not.
This is really about to happen. You're listening to Political Rewind. It's 3:39 in the afternoon. We'll be back after a very quick break.
Got a used car that's taking up space in your garage or driveway? Donate it to GPB. We'll take care of everything from picking up the car for free to sending you the paperwork for your tax deduction. Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Todd Ream, Buddy Darden, Bradley George. Buddy, you said something during the break. You said Iowa caucus is the most confusing thing you've ever seen. I covered a lot of Iowa caucuses. It means going out on a very, very cold night, typically, and meeting with all of your friends to be able to register your choice, right?
That's right. The best example I've ever seen of the Iowa caucus was on TV several weeks ago on The Good Wife, when Peter Florek was running third, and incidentally didn't do very well, even though the good wife was out there with him. But
spoiler alert.
You meet in your caucus, and so many people stand in this corner, so many people stand in the other corner. If you get a certain amount of percentage of the caucus, then you stay in it until we decide where the votes go. It is thoroughly confusing, and I don't think representative of the electorate necessarily.
Oh, okay, so this is true for both Democrats and Republicans.
As a longtime convention goer in Georgia Republican circles, I can tell you that I suspect that there are folks who are plotting dilatory tactics for the Iowa caucus with the idea that if you draw it out as long as possible, people, the newcomers especially, are going to start wanting to go home. As it gets 9, 10 o'clock at night, the less committed are going to cruise out. And I think that there is somebody somewhere in Iowa plotting out how to do that.
All right, so we're going to talk more as we get right on top of Iowa on Political Rewind. We'll do a little bit more about precisely how that whole process unfolds, who we think it's going to favor right before it takes place. But Jim Galloway, let's move on. There's a debate Sunday night, another weekend debate. Once more, this between the Democratic candidates. Martin O'Malley will be there. Hillary Clinton will be there. And so, of course, will Bernie Sanders. And before we talk about what could happen, let's point out that, once again, the Democratic Party chooses to do this
on
a Sunday night. It's opposite a big event, a sporting event or something. Is there a playoff game?
We're going to be watching Downton Abbey.
Well, that too, yeah, that's the other thing.
Okay, so once again, this notion that the Democrats really have been wanting to, you know, have a coronation for Hillary Clinton and are eager to have a lot of viewers watching the debate. But this could kind of backfire
she could use some of this attention.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. Sanders coming on strong.
He's up by 14 points in New Hampshire. He's kind of knocking on the door in Iowa. I've got a theory that the more chaotic the Republican race is on that side, the more Democrats see that they may be facing either Cruz or Trump, the more comfortable they are on their side with challenging the status quo. I think they feel a little bit more easy about their chances with Bernie.
Jim, you may be right, except last night I was with three current Georgia congressmen, one also from Maryland, who is the whip of the U.S. House.
Look, could I interrupt long enough to point out that when you don't name these people but say three Georgia congressmen, since there are only three, we kind of know who you're talking
about. All right, let me say I was with John Lewis, I was with Hank Johnson, I was with David Scott.
Well, Sanford Bishop was not there, right?
And former Congressman John Barra, former Governor Roy Barnes, and Steny Hoyer, the Democratic whip. And all of us have the same opinion about Bernie. We think he's a well-intentioned and a good man and a sincere man. However, we do not believe, collectively, we do not believe that people in the United States are going to elect someone who ran on a socialist ticket and was a conscientious objector in the Vietnam War.
Have you endorsed Hillary Clinton?
Not officially, but I've always said I'm going to vote for her, and I've contributed to a campaign. So, I mean, I am in her camp. There's no question that I am there. So I'm not going to be coy with you about it. I know Bernie Sanders. I sat with him at the dedication of the Clinton Library back in 2004. We're okay. Most people like me who might be considered establishment Democrats just don't think that Bernie Sanders is elected.
Bradley, it's hard to imagine a path to the nomination. Let's say that Sanders pulls an upset in Iowa, as Barack Obama did against Hillary Clinton 8 years ago, 7 years ago, and then wins Iowa, as the polls show he likely can do. It's hard to see the path once they
turn South Carolina. I mean, it's a primary,
isn't
after
it?
That. Yeah, and that's been the struggle for him, is getting votes of Southern Democrats, and especially the African American establishment in states like Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, getting Democrats who like that behind his campaign.
And he does have a hardcore base of folks, but it's very small. You know, you could fit him in a small room, and he just has never had the opportunity to build out the campaign infrastructure to run a campaign in multiple states.
All right, we're going to have fun watching that. That debate Sunday night. Well, yeah, buddy, go ahead.
Where do the Sanders people go, assuming he doesn't get the nomination? They have absolutely nowhere to go. They're not going to go with Trump or Cruz or even Bush or Rubio or Kasich.
They go back to the hookah bar in East Atlanta, I think.
Oh, Todd. All right. Let's talk state politics for a few minutes if we can. Jim, the governor gave his State of the State speech earlier this week on Wednesday, and he's made it clear that he's going to have to once again delay implementation of the education reforms that he's been telling us for a couple of years are so important to the state. But his merit pay proposal for teachers is now on the back burner because he got a lot of opposition in the legislature and among teacher groups. And now is going to put together a group of people, including teachers, to revisit how we do that. And now, though, he's also said we really can't move forward right now on configuring the way in which we give funding to schools across the state, quality-based education funding formula.
Right. For the second time in 4 years, we have a primary that's going to come within, 5 or 6 weeks after the end of the session. That gives you've got 236 lawmakers in the Capitol and that who have the heebie-jeebies over that.
Yeah.
That qualifying would come while they were debating both of those proposals, perhaps giving one side or the other a primary opponent, and then all hell breaks loose.
Todd, is it, governors have tried this or have said they're going to try it, and especially the funding formula is really a third rail. Question is there ever a year in the legislature when somebody is going to be able to make this happen?
Well, I saw you had Representative Terry Rogers on Lawmakers the other night,
yep.
And he, I thought his discussion was very incisive. He said that this is Nathan Deal. This is how he works. He's very methodical. He doesn't get rushed. He doesn't, just bull his way through it. And he's very much a technician of government.
Yes, but, buddy, this is the second year in a row that we're being told the governor doesn't think it's time to move forward yet. And so there are a lot of people who wonder, as Jim suggested, whether politics is really standing in the way.
It could be, but also Governor Deal is a very cautious individual.
Well, as you know.
And he realizes he's dealing with something of momentous importance here that hasn't been changed since Joe Frank Harris was governor back around 1986. And QBE, by the way, when it was enacted, was quite controversial, and it took a number of years for that to settle down. And so I'm somewhat at sympathy with the governor here because he wants to be sure he gets it right the first time. And if you take the merit pay issue and put it aside here, we're looking at some very, very difficult issues that, frankly, don't need to be rushed into. And so I think he's probably doing the right thing and holding back on it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's going to happen at all. Even if we put it off a year, 2017, then we start getting into the thick of a gubernatorial campaign, and it becomes an issue in that.
Yeah, I think you'll have a set of gubernatorial candidates who want it off the table by 2018, which I think makes 2017 a pretty good year to get it done, get a lot of stuff done.
So speaking about issues in the legislature that come before a big election this year. Todd, Josh McCoon, Senator McCoon was on the show, on the Lawmaker show the other night. And, we talked, of course, about SB 129, the RFRA bill, the Religious Liberty Bill. But I also asked him why he felt it was necessary to introduce his resolution calling for a constitutional amendment that would make English the official language of the state. It's already a statute in law. And he said, well, I think we need to assure that it is in perpetuity attached to the Constitution so no one can change it. But here's the question. Isn't this the kind of red meat that a legislator up for re-election wants to take back to his district and tell his voters he got?
Josh is a good friend. I had lunch with him yesterday, and there is no shortage of red meat for him to carry back to the district. He has got plenty to last him a lifetime there. But I think what it illustrates is the growing concern among people outside of the of Metro Atlanta that this is the last chance we're ever going to have on some of these measures to permanently take care of some issues that are going to slip beyond our control if we let it go even one more session.
It's interesting, buddy, that we're talking about this on the same day the Atlanta Constitution reports that the Georgia Association of Latin American Officials, GALEO is the acronym. Yeah. They're asking that ballots be printed in Hall County and Gwinnett County in Spanish because of the large Spanish-speaking populations up
there. Absolutely, and I think they probably will be able to make a pretty good case for it. In addition to that, in today's AJC also, that was a full-page ad by almost 300 ministers of conscience in opposition to RFRA.
SB 129, yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of division of opinion in this state, and I just think there are some issues that you cannot solve legislatively that have got to solve them, that's got to work themselves out, and I don't see either one of these issues passing the General Assembly this year.
So you mean you don't see the religious liberty bills passing
right.
the General Assembly?
Right. Except for one. And that's the great old Pastor Protection Act. I think
speakers,
it certainly will be passed, and I think that we'll all be a better state for it.
I do have a question about that I haven't seen answered. It makes reference to the beliefs of the denomination, and it's not clear to me that this protects non-denominational churches, of which some of the largest in Metro Atlanta and certainly throughout the state. Will not be covered by this.
See a fix to that bill by Tuesday.
Jim Galloway. So, Jim, let's go back for a minute to this request by Galeo to print ballots in Spanish in those two counties up there. Obviously, both heavy Hispanic populations or growing Hispanic populations. It does raise this, clearly Democrats would like to see Spanish language.
Right. Especially in within the city of Gainesville.
Yeah.
You've got a tremendous Spanish Hispanic population there. They're not voters yet, but their children are growing up fast, and they're going to be the voters. This does get to Todd's point. Things are changing very quickly here.
Yeah. Todd, let me turn to you on a poll that you gave some attention to in Georgia Pundit the other day. Rosetta Stone has taken a snapshot of where maybe voters are going to go. Lynn Westmoreland is not running for re-election to Congress from the 3rd District down there around the Columbus area, South Metro in Columbus. And the question is, who is going to pick up that mantle and make the race? What did the Rosetta Stone poll say about this early look at what voters are thinking?
Well, it gave the head start to Josh McCoon. And Matt Ramsey and Mike Crane were among the other at the top of it. What I thought was really interesting was they asked a question about RFRA, the Religious Freedoms Bill, and it came in at something like 4-1 favorable in that district. I was speaking to a state senator who was not on that list, and he did a survey of his constituents, and it came in about 4-1 in favor of RFRA. And so one thing it's that those of us who live in Atlanta and ply our trade have to remember is that the 3rd congressional district is vastly different from the 7th in Gwinnett County or what we're used to seeing. And so it's going to be a different bear. What's really interesting to me is you've got two announced candidates in the 2nd district where Sanford Bishop routinely gets reelected in double digits.
A Democrat who's held that seat forever in Republican territory.
You've got two announced Republicans for that and no announced Republicans for a solid seat that will last somebody the rest of their career.
Interesting. Well, I think most people, Jim, think that Josh McCoon really has in mind is running for Attorney General.
Right. I think, but going back to the Rosetta Stone poll, I think what it shows is that Lynn Westmoreland has no natural heir in that district.
Right.
I think anybody could come in and grab that seat.
Buddy,
with money.
You know, being in a United States House of Representatives today is not what it was when you were a congressman.
No, it's not. And I think
who wants the job?
I think Lynn Moreland is doing exactly the right thing. He wants to come back and be governor. And I think he is probably right now the favorite for governor of the state of Georgia, because especially with his connection with the deal administration and the deal machine. So he probably had more to do with Nathan Deal getting elected governor than anybody else in Washington. So I think he's primed to make a race for governor. And at the same time, he's been up there, I believe, 10 years, maybe 12, 10 years, and he's gone as far, he knows, as he can go. He doesn't have any Washington aspirations. He's gone up there. He's done a good job. He's voted the views and values of his constituents. He's kept his nose clean, and I think he wants to do something else. I think he's bored.
Going back to Josh McCoon possibly running for this seat for a minute, he talked to the Columbus Ledger-Inquirer right after Westmoreland announced he wasn't going to run for re-election, and he was just kind of thinking aloud, and he said, you know, you're running for Congress, you got to run every 2 years,
well,
you got to travel
yeah.
back to the district,
yeah.
you got to fly into Hartsfield-Jackson,
yeah.
and then drive back to Columbus.
Yeah, Buddy lived in Washington when he was a member of
right.
the House.
Right, so yeah, does he really want to do that? I mean, versus representing a state senator, running for attorney general.
Precisely.
For a lot of people, the real downside to running for Congress is you might win.
That is exactly right.
And the Congress has continued to beat up upon itself for the last, even after Republicans took over, they couldn't stop it, and they've made it a less desirable place to work.
Jim Galloway, I think we're going to wait and take this issue up next week, but I would really recommend people go to the website, the AJC. It's on Political Insider, I think. You wrote a really interesting column the other day for the paper in which you talked about the poll that you all had done. The thesis of your column, you've got about 30 seconds, and we'll discuss it later. We'll make this a tease.
Well, if you're asked what how the state economy is, if you're a Republican, you love it. If you're a Democrat, you hate it. If you're asked what the national economy is like, if you're a Democrat, you love it. If you're a Republican, you hate it. We have, it's all one view, and yet we're basing our judgments, our facts on our political beliefs, not on the unemployment rate.
Your column points out the unbelievable polarization that exists in this state as it does in much of the country. We'll talk about that more on a Political Rewind coming up.
Bill, could I reflect on the wonderful legacy left by the great statesman Mike Eagle?
Yeah, good.
His service was yesterday at Christ the King, and I don't think there's anyone who represents what's good about public service than Mike Eagle, and we're going to miss him.
Thank you for doing that. A lot of us watched him, covered him. He was truly a lovely man and a smart member of the Georgia legislature. He will be missed. Thank you for saying that, Buddy. Look, we're out of time. Bradley George, Buddy Darden, Todd Rehm, Jim Galloway, our thanks to you for being here. We're back again on Political Rewind next Wednesday at 2 o'clock. My thanks to Daryl Welch, to Jonathan Reedy, and a welcome to Jenny Ament, who is about to make the transition to being the producer of Political Rewind and Two-Way Street. By the way, on Two-Way Street this weekend, John Meacham talking about George Herbert Walker Bush. And talk about a gentleman in politics. He was one. I really hope you'll check out Two-Way Street this weekend. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.